The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome to Memorable Moments in History. It was this week in March in 1911. We now mark the anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City. In one of the darkest moments of American industrial history, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory in New York City burns down, killing 145 workers on this day in 1911. The tragedy led to the development of a series of laws and regulations that better protected the safety of factory workers. The Triangle Factory, owned by Max Planck and Isaac Harris, was located in the top three floors of the 10-story Ash Building in downtown Manhattan. It was a sweatshop in every sense of the word, a cramped space lined with workstations and packed with poor immigrant workers, mostly teenage women who did not speak English. At the time of the fire, there were four elevators with access to the factory floors, but only one was fully operational, and it could hold only 12 people at a time. There were two stairways down to the street, but one was locked from the outside to prevent theft by the workers, and the other opened inward only. The fire escape, as all would come to see, was shoddily constructed and could not support the weight of more than a few women at a time. Planck and Harris already had a suspicious history of factory fires. Their Triangle Factory was twice scorched in 1902, while their Diamond Waste Company factory burned twice in 1907 and 1910. It seems that Planck and Harris deliberately torched their workplaces before business hours in order to collect on the large fire insurance policies they purchased, a practice not uncommon in the early 20th century. While this was not the cause of the 1911 fire, it contributed to the tragedy, as Planck and Harris refused to install sprinkler systems and take out other safety measures in case they needed to burn down their shops again. Added to this delinquency were Planck and Harris's notorious anti-worker policies. Their employees were paid a mere $15 a week, despite working 12 hours a day, every day. With the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union led a strike in 1909, demanding higher pay and shorter and more predictable hours, Planck and Harris Company was one of the few manufacturers who resisted, hiring police as thugs to imprison the striking women and paying off politicians to look the other way. On March 25th, a Saturday afternoon, there were 600 workers at the factory when a fire broke out at a rag bin on the 8th floor. The manager turned the fire hose on it, but the hose was rotted and its valve was rusted shut. Panic ensued as the workers fled to every exit. The elevator broke down only after four trips, and women began jumping down the shaft to their deaths. Those who fled down the wrong set of stairs were trapped inside and burned alive. Other women trapped on the 8th floor began jumping out the windows, which created a problem for the firefighters, whose hoses were crushed by the falling bodies. Also, the firefighters' ladder stretched only as high as the 7th floor, and their safety nets were not strong enough to catch the women who were jumping three at a time. Planck and Harris were on the building's top floor with some workers when the fire broke out. They were able to escape by climbing onto the roof and hopping to an adjoining building. The fire was out within a half an hour, but not before 49 workers had been killed by the fire, and another 100 or so were piled up dead in the elevator shaft or in the sidewalk. The workers' union organized a march on April 5th to protest the conditions that led to the fire. It was attended by 80,000 people. Though Blank and Harris were put on trial for manslaughter, they managed to get off scot-free. Still, the massacre for which they were responsible did finally compel the city to enact reform. In addition to the Sullivan-Hoey Fire Prevention Law passed that October, the New York Democratic set took up the cause of the worker and became known as a reform party. This week also marks the anniversary of the last U.S. troops departing from Somalia. At the end of a largely unsuccessful 15-month mission that last U.S. troops departed Somalia, March 25, 1994, leaving 20,000 U.N. troops behind to keep the peace and facilitate nation-building in the divided country. In 1992, civil war, clan-based fighting, and the worst African drought of the century created famine conditions that threatened one-fourth of Somalia's population with starvation. In August 1992, the United Nations began a peacekeeping mission to the country to ensure the distribution of food and medical aid. On December 4th, with deteriorating security and UN troops unable to control Somalia's warring factions, U.S. President George Bush ordered 25,000 U.S. troops into Somalia. Although he promised the troops involved that humanitarian mission was not an open-ended commitment, Operation Restore Hope remained unresolved when Bill Clinton took over the presidency in January 1993. Like his predecessor, Clinton was anxious to bring the Americans home, and in May, the mission was formally handed back to the United Nations. By June, only 4,200 U.S. troops remained. However, on June 5th, 24 Pakistani UN peacekeepers inspecting a weapons storage site were ambushed and massacred by soldiers under Somali's warlord, General Mohammed Adid. U.S. and UN forces subsequently began an extensive search for the elusive strongman, and in August, 400 elite U.S. troops from Delta Force and the U.S. Rangers arrived on a mission to capture Adid. 2 months later, on October 3rd and 4th, 18 of those soldiers were killed, 84 wounded during a disastrous assault on Mogadishu's Olympia Hotel in search of Adid. The bloody battle, which lasted 17 hours, was the most violent U.S. combat firefight since Vietnam. 3 days later, with Adid still at large, President Clinton cut his losses and ordered a total U.S. withdrawal on March 25, 1994. The last U.S. troops left Somalia. It was in Italy in the year 421 that the city of Venice was founded. In 708, Constantine began his reign as Catholic Pope, and in 1655, Christian Huygens discovered Titan. Titan is Saturn's largest satellite. Both these events occurred in 1807 in March. The first railway passenger service began in England, and the British Parliament abolished the slave trade. In 1879, Japan invaded the kingdom of Liuqi, or Ryukyu Islands, formerly known as a vassal of China. And in 1895, Italian troops invaded Abyssinia, better known as Ethiopia. Fourth week of March in 1900 found the U.S. Socialist Party being formed in Indianapolis, and in 1923, the British government granted Transjordan autonomy. In 1931, 50 people were killed in riots that broke out in India, and Gandhi was one of the many people assaulted. And in 1931, the Scottsboro Boys were arrested in Alabama. For you spice freaks out there, it was on March 20, 1941, that the first paprika bill was incorporated in Dolan, South Carolina. And in 1940, the U.S. agreed to give Britain and France access to all American warplanes. Finally, in 1954, RCA manufactured its first color TV set and began mass production. Humble Howard Day falls this year on March the 25th. Howard Cosell, a.k.a. Cohen, was born on this day in 1918. Cosell came to be the most liked and the most disliked sports journalist across America. Cosell agreed when others described him as arrogant, pompous, obnoxious, vain, cruel, verbose, and a show-off. Yet still others said he forgot to include irritating, generous, funny, paranoid, charming, egomaniacal, and insecure. A New York attorney, Cosell ventured into the world of network sports journalism through his association with WABC Radio and TV in New York in the 1950s and early 1960s. He was featured as the boxing announcer for ABC Sports and, under Rune Arledge, filled various sports positions on Wide World of Sports from horse racing to Olympic competition. Cosell would, in a stentorian and often difficult-to-understand syntax, make use of his abundant vocabulary that contained big, big words that sent sports fans scurrying for their dictionaries. Always outspoken and frequently controversial, Cosell would tell it like it is, the title of one of his best-selling books on the subject of sports and broadcasting. It was Cosell who would be the first to claim that Cassius Clay, or Muhammad Ali, would be a media star, and he championed Ali's fight against the draft. His association with the boxer put him in front of congressional committees. It made him a regular guest lecturer in college classrooms. Cosell later quit broadcasting boxing matches and openly expressed a loathing for that sport and for football as well. Humble Howard was also host of a weekly program, not a sports program, for ABC Contemporary Radio, interviews and commentary titled Speaking of Everything. Cosell was a major figure with colleague Jim, bringing the hard news story to the minds and souls of a nation in 1972, when several Olympians were tragically slain during the Winter Olympics in Germany. He later became more outspoken, even against his own colleagues, who he had worked with for so many years. Many people felt that Cosell became a bitter, broken man in his later years, following the death of his wife, Emmy. She was the only one who could tell him to shut up, Howard. Nobody cares. The once powerful voice that roared left Monday Night Football after 14 years. Howard Cosell died in 1995. Rune Arledge said, Howard Cosell was one of the most original people ever to appear on American TV. He became a giant by telling the truth in an industry that was not used to hearing it and considered it revolutionary. It was this week in 1867 that the sculptor of Mount Rushmore National Memorial, those big heads out west of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt, was born, none other than John Gutzon Borglum. It was also this week in 1867 that the classical conductor Arturo Toscanini was born in Milan. Performed at Carnegie Hall, Philadelphia Orchestra, the NBC Symphony Orchestra, and he was a cellist at the age of 19. This week in 1881, the composer Béla Bartók was born. The composer of Mikrokosmos, Concerto for Orchestra, Music for Strings, Percussion and Celeste, Solo Sonata for Violin. He died September the 26th, 1945. 1901 saw the birth of Ed Begley, the actor in The Unsinkable Molly Brown, Sweet Bird of Youth, Sorry, Wrong Number, and On Dangerous Ground. 1908 this week was the birth of Academy Award-winning director David Lean, famous for Lawrence of Arabia in 1962, The Bridge Over the River Kwai in 1957, and Dr. Zhivago. 1938 saw the birth of Hoyt Axton, the singer-musician, songwriter, such famous tunes as Greenback Dollar, The Pusher, Joy to the World, Never Been to Spain. Axton's mother, May Boren Axton, wrote Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel, and he also acted in The Rousters, Gremlins, Disorganized Crime, The Civil War, Kingfish, A Story of Huey P. Long, and King Cobra. He died October the 26th, 1999. 1947 sees the birth of Reginald Kenneth Dwight. You might know him better as Elton John. And finally, in March of 1967, the Olympic bronze medalist figure skater Debbie Thomas was born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Well, this has been Stephen J. Lowenstein reading to you. Join me later for another edition of Memorable Moments in History.